Okay, I think we'll make a start then. So, last time we were talking about the problem of lexical analysis, or lexing of computer languages. And the idea was that in some language like Java, you, the programmer, type some stream of characters like this. Let's suppose you're in a bad mood, so you're not writing with any white spaces at all or anything like that. And the compiler has the job of chopping it up into the sort of minimal meaningful units of the program, and also sort of classifying them or tagging them according to what sort of things they are. And we said that using the technology of regular expressions, no one actually has to write a program to do this, because all you need to do is write down some regular expressions that specify the possible forms of the various lexical elements you have in mind, various forms of identifiers and numeric literals and special keywords and things like that. And you can just type them in as regular expressions in some syntax. And a special kind of program called a lexer generator will take such a description and will automatically write your lexer for you. And so we had a little example of some source code like this, where you can write some regular expressions up there, and then you can write a bunch of instructions down here, which says if you see this, or if you see something match these form, do this, and classify the lexical token you've got in the appropriate way here. So it turns out this is very powerful. So this is just a little sample here. But even if you wanted a complete lexical description of the whole of, say, the Java programming language, that wouldn't take very much. I mean, kind of probably 200 lines max of code in this kind of style would be enough to give you a complete lexical description of Java. So it's quite powerful. And then you hit a button and you get your lexical analyzer for Java. Let's think about how this is going to work, how lexical analysis on the basis of these regular expressions might work, given in mind what we know about regular expressions and things like that. So the idea is we've got various lexical classes. So these are things like the class of identifiers, or the class of numeric literals, or the class containing just the keyword while, which will get a class to itself, or the class containing just an open bracket, which gets a class to itself. And for each of these, we've got a regular expression of some kind, which is what you include in your lexing file. So supposing we start by building non-deterministic finite automata for each of those, and that's a thing we know we can do, and the size of the automata, if they're non-deterministic, the size of these things is going to be not too big in relation to the regular expressions we start off with. Okay? So let's just think for the moment about a slightly simpler problem of, if you're given just a single lexical token, our problem is just to sort of recognize what kind of lexical token it is, what class it belongs to. So this is the problem we're trying to solve. We've got these finite automata, one for each. And then we can just take the automaton, which I've written as a disjoint union of these. So this is just the automaton you get by sticking n1 to nk side by side. And you can run, effectively, you're running all of these in parallel, as you go through your input stream, you're keeping track of all the states you could be in any of these machines. Okay, so you don't know which of your lexical classes you're in, so you're trying all of them in parallel. And then once you've got to the end of your string, you look at your machines and you see that in some of them we might be in an accepting state, perhaps along with other states. And if we're in an accepting state, that means the string could be a string of that lexical class. Okay. What if there's more than one string more than one lexical class that we could be in? Well, the idea is that we prioritize them. So I've listed them here in order of priority. So you'll recall that when we list these instructions here, there's a priority ordering here. So the fact that we've put this line saying while before the line for identifier, because after all, normally any sequence of letters could be a valid identifier, but by putting this while line first, we're saying the while takes priority. If you see the sequence while, that's to be construed as the keyword while rather than as an identifier or variable name while. So you choose the smallest value of I or the highest priority such that we're in an accepting state. So we're going to assign this as the lexical class for our item. And then we can perform the action that's specified for that class. By the action that's specified, I mean these things over on the right here. And that will typically be either return the lexeme we've got tagged as being of a certain class, or ignore it, throw it away if it's something like white space and comments or something like that. So that's how we can use NFAs just to recognize a lexical token and to classify it in the right task. But we haven't addressed the most obvious problem here, which is how do we know how to chop up our string of input into lexical tokens? So how do we know we've reached the end of a current lexical token? So notice that this needn't be the first time your machine enters an accepting state, because the thing about these strings of increasing length, I, if 2, and if 2, 3, so all of these are valid lexical tokens in Java. So if, as you know, is a keyword, and the other three are possible identifiers. So these could be variable names. So all of these are valid tokens in Java. So if we're processing the string if 2, 3, then at all the stages along the way, we'll be in an accepting state. So how do we know when we've reached the end of the token? How do we know when to chop off and say, right, starting a new token now? So let's see how this problem's addressed. So in most computer languages, there's a convention which is called the principle of longest match. And that convention says that if you have a choice between taking this much string and this much string as a single lexical token, you should always take as much as possible. So you should always take the current lexical token to be as long as possible, okay? You take the longest possible string, starting from the position where you're reading, that would be a valid lexical token. And then you chop them off. So that means of these four, if you had the input IF23, and let's say you had a space following that, then you'd always take the whole of this as your lexical token rather than any of these, because this is the longest possibility. Okay. So how would we detect when we've got the longest possible lexical token? So let's say we're reading in some input characters, and we're keeping track of all the possible states we might be in our combined non-deterministic finite automaton. And we keep doing this. We can keep doing this until the machine expires. And what I mean by the machine expires is if you ever reach a point where the set of possible states you might be in is now empty, okay? That means once it's empty, it's going to stay empty whatever further characters you add. So if you reach the state where the set of states is empty, that means not only your string, the string that you've got so far, can't be in any of the lexical classes you've got, but no future longer string could be in any of those lexical classes either, because if there's no state you can be in, there's nowhere you can go to from it. Okay. So once you've reached the empty set of states, you've expired. There's another possibility, incidentally, which is you might have exceeded the maximum possible lexeme length allowable in your language. So I think in Java there's some rule like an identifier can be at most 255 characters long. Okay, so if you really want to annoy someone who's trying to read your code, okay, use a 250 character variable name. Lovely. So then we know we've gone, by the time that the machine's expired, we know we've gone too far. So how do we know what the longest possible match is, what the longest possible lexeme is? Well, to know that, we'd better have been keeping track of the last time we were in an accepting state, okay? So if, as we go through the machine, every time we're in an accepting state, we update a record saying, right, this is the last accepting state we were in, corresponding to the longest lexeme state lexeme we've found so far. And we also keep a record of which of the NFA components or which lexical class that corresponds to. Then after it expires, we can look back and see what was the last point at which I had a valid lexical token. Okay? So if you think about it, there are three positions we need. If this is our input, this is our program text here, character by character, there are three relevant positions we need to keep track of. There's the start of the current lexeme that we're processing. So let's say we're processing the input starting from this point. And we start from this point, we read these characters in, we trundle through the execution of our machine. Anytime we reach a possible lexeme endpoint, we update our record. And let's say this is the most recent one, and this was of class I, and we've gone to a couple more characters. And we can carry on reading, even if it goes from this to a non-accepting state. We can carry on reading and trundling through our NFA until the thing expires. Okay, and when this thing expires, we say, aha, the longest match must be the lexeme from here to here. Okay, so we chop at this point, and we say that these four characters are a single lexeme, and we know that the class it has is the class at this point. And then we have to carry on. So then we start again with the start of the next current lexeme position moved to this position here. And then we can start again, carry on from there. So that's how we can use the principle of longest match, implement the principle of longest match. So notice this principle of longest match, at a single stroke, it removes all kind of ambiguities from the lexing process. So there's only one possible correct way of lexing a string, and that's the way according to principle of longest match. And so notice that this is completely blind to any future stages in the languaging processing pipeline. So for example, if I write A minus minus B in Java, this will get lexed as A and then minus minus, because this minus minus is an operator in Java. So and then B, so it'll get lexed like this. Even though this sequence of lexical tokens can never possibly occur in a valid Java program. Whereas if I'd split it up like this into four separate lexemes, then it could. Because you would be allowed to write A minus minus B. Heaven knows why you would write that rather than A plus B. But anyway, it's allowed in the rules of Java that you could write A minus minus B. But if the input is like this, the principle of longest match forces us to choose this possible lexing rather than this one, even though this one couldn't be part of a valid Java program, whereas this one could. So the parsing phase later on will pick up that this is rubbish. So in other words, this lexing, there's no ambiguities in the lexing phase here, and as a consequence, it's kind of blind to any future stages of language processing. That, as we see, that's a big difference from what happens in natural language. So we'll come on to that, hopefully, in just a second. Okay, so that says what I've just told you, how this works. So maybe it looks a bit complicated, but the ideas here are the basis for a reasonably efficient lexing procedure. And we have this terrific advantage that we don't need to write a lexer. We can just generate it automatically. And because a difference between lexing and the sort of pattern searching that I was talking about last lecture is in lexing, basically, hopefully the same language definition or the same regular expressions will be used hundreds and hundreds of times over for lots and lots of different source files. So it's a bit, in contrast to what's the case with grep, it's a bit more worthwhile here doing some optimizations, maybe making the thing deterministic. Or something like that, doing some optimizations to your state machines using the kinds of methods we've described, converting to DFAs, state minimizations, or something like that, in order to speed up your lexing. So that's pretty much what I wanted to say about that. So now a new topic, which is a very different kind of application of... Right, I'll just need to... Even better, right. Okay, so we've looked at some applications of the technology of regular languages in a computer science sort of context. And now I'd like to look at some applications in a natural language arena. Okay, so we're going to talk about something which is vaguely analogous to the lexing problem for programming languages. It's a sort of similar thing at the first stage of processing you might want to do for natural languages, and that's the problem of morphology parsing, parsing of individual word, analysis of individual words to break them up into their constituent grammatical elements. So I'll explain what the problem is, and then I'll tell you a bit about a very slight refinement of the machinery we've got so far that we can use, called finite state transducers, and which you may be familiar with from Informatics 1. And then I'll show you how these finite state transducers can be used on this to attack this problem. And I should say, this lecture is taken pretty much lifted directly from chapter 3 of the Jurafsky and Martin book, so there's very little claim to originality here. Okay, so what's the problem? So the issue is that in lots of languages, it's very common for words to be built up from a basic kind of stem which carries the basic dictionary meaning of the word, and then a bunch of prefixes or suffixes that can be tagged onto that, which in general are called affixes, if you want to allow both prefixes and suffixes, which carry some kind of relevant grammatical information about the function that the word is playing. So, for example, we've got the English word cats, and we all see that the basic dictionary stem word here is cat, and the S that's being added on is indicating that it's plural rather than singular. So in terms of a sort of more grammatical representation of what's going on, we've got the stem cat, okay, with the grammatical information that it's a noun in this case, and that it's a plural noun. So think of these as sort of attributes giving you, which are sort of attached to the word cat. Likewise, we've got word walking, think of as a verb. The basic word you'd look up in the dictionary would be walk, and then we've got the suffix ing, which is a present participle suffix for the verb. By the way, don't worry too much if you're not completely on top of all the sort of grammatical terminology that's going on in these slides. I hope you can get the intuition anyway. Don't worry if you wouldn't know the ing. I mean, you all know that there's an ing ending in English. Don't worry if you didn't know that it was called present participle. There's another example here. The word smoothest, so we've got the basic adjective smooth and the suffix est, meaning it's the superlative form. We're talking about the most smooth thing. Okay, so morphological parsing is basically the problem of taking the surface form, that's the basic original form that you're given, the form that you read and write, and extracting from it or analysing it in order to obtain this more grammatical lexical form, which gives you and the information about what's going on here, and that's more relevant to the meaning of the thing. And this is a non-trivial problem because, well, there are two kinds of reasons why it's interesting. One is because quite a lot of words in languages have irregular forms, so the plural isn't always formed by adding s. There are annoying words, especially, and English is particularly bad for this, yeah? As you'll know if you're not a native English speaker. You have to learn all these irregular forms, the fact that the plural of goose is geese, for example, not gooses. And there are also things which are not irregular. They follow systematic rules, but there are rules you need to know. Like if you just try adding S to certain words that end in certain things, if the noun stem ends in either an S or an X or a Z or CH or SH, you need to insert an extra E here when you form the plural. So that's a kind of systematic rule that you want to take account of. So problem is, we want to see whether we can get from this surface form to this lexical form. Why do we want to do that? Well, fairly obviously, if you want to do anything kind of remotely interesting or intelligent with natural language that involves extracting the meaning of a natural language text, if you want to get at all deep into the meaning, you're going to want to sort of know this information about whether a verb is past or present tense, whether a noun is singular or plural. So it's an obvious first step towards meaning extraction, just the same way as lexing is an obvious first step towards being able to compile or execute a program. But if you think about it, even a much humbler task like spell checking can benefit from this thing, because we want to know what the bottom line is. We want to know what sequences of letters are possible words. So is walking a possible word form? So if we know a bit about the morphology of English, the way in which words are built up, we know, and our dictionary contains a verb walk, then we'll be able to deduce from that walking is a possible form. So we don't flag up a spelling error there. But why don't we, you might say, why don't we forget all that and just list all the derived forms separately in our words list? So from a verb walk, in English you can form walks, like he or she walks, walked, walking. And for a verb in English, that's about it. So you could say, well, for a spell checker, wouldn't it be okay just to list all these forms separately and have done with it? Well, that might be okay, and probably a lot of spell checkers do just that kind of thing. That's okay for English, because English isn't a very morphologically rich language. We've got these four forms for verbs, and that's not very much. And you see, we've got at most one suffix added on to the end of a verb here. But if you've learned other languages like French, for instance, you'll know that the morphology is a lot more complicated. There are, you know, whole tables of verb conjugations you have to learn and things like that. And there can be multiple suffixes or affixes all piled on. And in a language like Turkish, apparently, it's possible to have a verb stem and then a sequence of about up to 10 suffixes conveying grammatical information tagged onto it. So you get a nice long verb form. And once you've looked at all the possible cross combinations of, you know, the possible suffixes that you can have in each place, so some of these might be recording information about the tense, whether it's past, present, or future. Some might be recording information about whether it's first, second, or third person, whether it's I, you, or he, she, it. Some whether it's a singular or plural subject. Some whether it's an indicative or subjunctive mood or something like that. Anyway, what it adds up to is that there are for quite a few verbs in Turkish, there are around 40,000 possible verb forms. So it would be distinctly impractical in that case to get a human to enter all the forms for all the verbs you want to use. So if you want a spelling checker for Turkish, okay, much better if you can do some morphology analysis. Okay. But even in English, the lexicon, the vocabulary in English is changing all the time. So even in English, it makes it easier to add new words if every time you want to add a new word, you just have to add the stem rather than just get a human to add the derived forms. So to consider a new verb like to frape, for example. Do you all know what fraping is? So it's short for Facebook rape. So if someone hijacks your Facebook ID and posts something as from you, then you've been fraped.
Yeah.
I've never been fraped myself, but I'm told it's not nice. So anyway, as soon as you, because if you've got a kind of native speaker awareness of English, as soon as you know that there's a word to frape, then you can, without hesitation, predict that there are words fraping, okay? And you know without being told that you would drop the E from frape when you add the ing suffix here, okay? So if we can encapsulate rules like that, it's better. And also, it's just much more interesting to see if we can implement something that encodes the kind of morphological rules of English than just to do this sort of brute listing. Okay.
What And what if the spin for the warp was different in the past?
Oh, okay, so even in English there are forms like, go, the past would be went, yeah. Which is going to be... Okay, so we want to take account of this sort of thing as well. So, yeah, you'll see that's part of what we want to account for. But when new words are added, they tend to follow the patterns of they tend to follow regular patterns. It's only sort of old words that have been sort of deeply embedded in the language for centuries that have these funny irregular forms. So new words tend to follow that are adopted by languages tend to follow regular patterns. Okay, so that's what we're trying to do. So there are two related problems you could think of. The one I've presented as primary here, which is parsing, which you could call parsing, just because it's the problem of analysing a given input. So parsing is going from the surface form, like foxes, to the underlying lexical form, fox, tagged as being a noun and as being a plural noun. But it's also equally reasonable to think about the opposite process. So given this, given perhaps some underlying representation of what you want to say, could you work out that the way to form this plural in English, the way to write this would be foxes with an E in it? Okay? So we can ask about going in either direction between these forms. And it's quite helpful to consider these two processes in conjunction with one another because they're very closely related. And whichever way we're going, it's often quite useful to proceed via what's called an intermediate form. So here's an intermediate form, and this is a form where basically we present the word as a sequence of the minimal meaningful units of which it's made up. So to write that, it's already there. Okay. So the idea is intuitively the word foxes is made up from the stem fox and then a plural suffix which is basically s. Okay. I say basically s because there's a rule in English which forces you to insert an e on certain times. But as far as but your starting point is that you're basically adding an s. So this symbol here I'm using as a word boundary, this hash symbol, that means we've got the end of a word, and this symbol here is a morpheme boundary because it's separating out these, and think of the fox here and the stem s as the sort of minimal meaningful units of the word. So the fox is carrying some information, the plural suffix is carrying some information. And you can see that this is kind of intermediate between the surface and lexical forms, and it's useful to have this intermediate form because we're separating out the basic analysis of a word as a sequence of morphemes, and that's kind of very specific to the grammar of the word and the fact that it's a noun, and we're talking about, I should be pointing down here for this bit, okay, the fact that it's a noun and there's certain ways of forming plurals in English, that gets taken care of here, whereas the fact that an E has to get inserted between the X and this S. That's nothing to do with nouns or plurals or anything. That's a sort of much more general feature of English as a whole. So that's that fact, as it were, lives in a different part of the language model. Because, for example, there's also a verb to fox, like to outwit someone, to fox them. And if you say he foxes someone, okay, so we could have fox as a verb, and the intermediate form would still look like this, although the S here would be telling you not that it's plural, but it's a third person singular verb. Okay, and then it's exactly the same rules of English that tell you how to get from this to this surface form. The rule that says add an E is applicable in both cases. So it's worth, as it were, separating out or factoring out that bit of the grammar model. So we're going to look at the translation, break up the translation into two steps. Right, whichever way we're doing it, we're going to go via this intermediate form. Right. So we want to do some translations between some languages of the rather simple kind. Because the idea is we want to think of this as an expression in some language, like a some, an expression that might be an expression in some regular language, and this is an expression that might be an expression in some other regular language, and so on. We want to think here about how we might translate between regular languages. So let's slightly modify our earlier definition of state machines to allow machines that can perform translation. So these are called finite state transducers. So if you start with a non-deterministic finite automaton allowing epsilon transitions, we talked about those before, those over a given alphabet. And remember, an ordinary NFA, it takes input symbols. But supposing we modify our definition just slightly so that transitions can not only accept input symbols, but can also spew out output symbols, perhaps optionally. So just as we can have a transition that may or may not consume an input symbol, depending on whether it's an epsilon transition or not, so we can have transitions that may produce an output symbol. So I've written the input symbol on the left of the colon, the output symbol on the right here. And here's a transition that produces an output symbol 0, and here's one that doesn't produce any output symbol here. So the idea is you can trundle through this machine on some input, and you'll go through some states, and as you make various transitions, you'll produce some output. And notice the output alphabet needn't be the same as the input alphabet in general. So here I've just got an input alphabet AB and an output alphabet 0, 1. So if you give a machine like this, it effectively gives you a way of translating from one regular language to another. And because it's a non-deterministic machine, it might be a multi-valued translation, so the same input might get translated in different ways depending on what sequences of states you go through, but let's not worry too much about that. Okay, so clickers at the ready. See if you've got the idea, just got the basic idea of this. So that's the same finite state transducer as I had on the previous slide. So if you start from the starting state and give it the input ABABABAB, what output will it produce? One of the first three strings, or is it the case that because it's non-deterministic, more than one output is possible? So this should be a not too hard question, so I'll give you 30 seconds starting now. Don't you love this bit? Okay, so the overwhelming majority, we've got the correct answer. That it's number two there. So just a brief description of what this does. Basically, A here is a symbol that will trigger it to produce some output, which will be either a 0 or a 1. And B here, you can think of as a kind of control character that will let you toggle between producing zeros and producing ones. Okay, so these A's will produce some zeros, then we switch and produce some ones, and then we switch to zeros, but switch back to ones before we've, okay, produce any zeros, so we get a fourth one, so we get this thing here. Very good, okay. Okay, so just in terms of the maths, we can give a formal definition of what a finite state transducer is, and it's very similar to what an epsilon NFA was, except that the transition relation, rather than being just a relation between sort of before states, and after states, and optional input symbols, we also allow an optional output symbol. So we might output a single symbol here, or we might have the empty output. Okay. And given that that's your basic transition relation, which is what basically the thing you draw in your graph, you can see how from that you can obtain a many-step transition relation telling you if you start from state Q, whether it's possible to get to state Q prime via the input string X and outputting string Y along the way. So, sorry, I couldn't quite be bothered to give you the formal details of that, but you can sort of imagine the idea. Now, here's an important point. So there's a sort of symmetry in this definition between inputs and outputs, okay? So I've treated inputs and outputs in basically the same way, and if you look at this, although in this example there's no epsilons for inputs, there could be. So my convention here has been that the inputs on the left and the outputs on the right. But you could read the same finite state transducer the other way around. So you could equally well apply it to a stream of zeros and ones and get it to produce a stream of A's and B's. So exactly, once you've taken the trouble to specify a finite state transducer, in a sense, you can run it either way. Although it might be, of course, always remembering that it might behave non-deterministically. You might get several possible behaviors, as you will if you've got epsilon transitions, then, yeah, if you see a zero, you can either do this, or you could do that and go back and then do your zero. But, going forwards. Yeah. Right. So formally, if we just sort of swap the roles of this input symbol and the output symbol, we just sort of flip the order of these components in this, of the second and third components in this relation, then from a finite state transducer T, we could obtain another one, which I've written T bar. It's a kind of dual of T, which just swaps the inputs and outputs. So we can think of two-way translations. And that's good because I've talked about parsing and generation as two directions of the same process. Okay. This mouse is itself toggled so that the normal forwards button seems to go backwards now and the backwards button seems to go forwards. I think I've worked it out. Okay. So let's consider the problem of going from a lexical form like fox plus noun plus plurals to a sequence of morphemes in this case. So our intermediate form would look like that. So let's just content ourselves with getting as far as the intermediate form for now. And we call this stage one. If I put that back, you can see it's called stage one. Okay. So we want to translate fox plus noun plus plural to foxes, but we want to translate something like goose plus noun plus plural to geese. So we're taking account of irregular forms at this stage, but we're not taking account of what happens when you put these two morphemes together and you get this E magic occurring, because that's going to come in the second stage. Okay, so roughly speaking, we could do that if we have a finite state transducer of roughly the following form. So basically, from your starting state here, we're going to have some stuff over here on the left, which I'll tell you more about in the second slide. And it's going to read read the noun stem, the fox or the goose part of this. And it's going to recognize whether basically that is the stem of a regular noun, whose plural is formed in a regular way according to regular rules. And we count fox as a regular noun for this purpose, because the adding the E bit that we're going to do later on, that is done by regular rules. So if you're a regular noun, you're here, okay? And we don't yet know whether it's going to be a singular or plural form, but we can then, if a regular noun stem takes us to here, we can then accept the input plus N, and that'll just be a check that it is a valid noun, it is a possible noun that we've got. And then we can choose either to accept the singular form, in which case all we need to output is the end of the word symbol, or we accept the plural attribute, and then we output this plural morpheme S. Okay, so as we work our way through this finite state machine, we'll be reading in bits of the input like here and outputting morphemes, and this will tell us that for a regular noun, the plural is formed by adding S, whereas the singular is formed by doing nothing. On the other hand, if we read in an irregular noun, Okay. There are two things we can do. We're using the fact here that it's non-deterministic. We could read in an irregular noun that's going to be followed, and we could correctly guess that it's going to be tagged as a singular noun. So we could read in the irregular noun stem like goose. Simply copy that to the output, and then when we see that it's singular, we just, we're done. Okay, we just note that we're at the end of the word. If we correctly guess that it's going to be a plural noun, okay, then we read in the irregular noun stem like goose, and we replace it, we output the irregular plural, which will be like geese, then acknowledge that that's a noun. And now, in contrast to up here where we added an S, we now know that we don't need to add an S anymore, because it's not geese's, it's just geese. We're in a state where we've recorded that we've already taken account of the pluralness of it, so we just jump to the finishing state. Okay, so you can see this is kind of non-deterministic, because if you've got goose plus noun plus plural, if you see goose, you might go either there or there. Okay, and we don't know yet if it's singular or plural, so you could keep track of both possibilities, and then when we see that it's plural, we know that it's this one, and the other one quietly dies. So let me just expand a little bit on what happens on the left-hand side of this picture. So, okay. Right, so here's just a very small sample of the expanded version of the bit of state machine that goes on the left-hand side. And I've just done it to take account of three nouns, cat, fox, and goose. So cat and fox are both regular nouns. Never mind that cats is formed just by adding S and foxes is formed by adding ES. We'll take care of that later. So basically any possible regular noun stem will trace out a path through this state machine, ending up into this state here. And at this state here, you know that you are at the end of a possible regular noun stem in English. So you know that if you want to pluralize from this point, then the thing to do is add S. Or you can trace out goose, and that will take you into this state, which records that you have read in an irregular noun stem. Okay, so we've read in it. We know that the string we've got so far is a possible noun stem in English, but it's one with an irregular plural. Now, I've written these single labels here. This is a transducer, but if I've written just a single letter, that means the output's the same as the input. So for all these transitions here, we read in the F, input F and output F, input O and output O. So we just copy the input to the output, okay? But we could decide, after reading the G of goose here, we could decide on reading the input O, we could guess that we're going to be talking about a plural goose, so we could output an E. So there's a sort of, there are several words in English that do this, yeah? A foot goes to feet, so we've got this idea that
OO can change to EE, and there are quite a lot of words that you might enjoy thinking of others. Okay,
so our state machine can either just, on inputting the word goose, it can either just output the word goose, or it can replace it by the irregular plural and reach this state where we know that, yeah, the only thing we can accept it from here is the plural marker. So these three states here correspond to these three states here, so the rest of this state machine carries on after that. So if you study this for a while, okay, as a transducer, you can satisfy yourself that it does this translation in roughly the form we want. Okay, so it'll take account of irregular plurals and also add the correct plural morpheme for regular forms. Okay, so that gets us from the lexical form to the intermediate form, and because we can run it either way, we can also use it to get back from the intermediate form to the lexical form. So now let's think of getting from the intermediate form, the sequence of morphemes, the one like this, to the surface form. And this is a point at which we want to apply our language-specific orthographic rules. So orthography means to do with writing system, because here I'm thinking about written English rather than spoken English. If it was spoken English, there'd be phonological rules. So here are some examples of orthographic rules in English, which you apply in the generation process. You apply after you've decided basically what morpheme sequence you want. You apply these rules so that it gets spelt right. Okay. So for example, consonant doubling. So if our stem ends in a single consonant, which is any one of these consonants typically, and we want to add the suffix ed or ing, then the consonant has to get doubled.
Okay, that's a systematic rule in English.
And the one we're talking about here, which is e insertion. So if we've got a morpheme which is just the morpheme s at the end of the word, and we add that to a stem which ends in any of these combinations, then we need to insert the E, as we've said. So I'm just going to think about a slight, just for simplicity, I'm going to ignore the CH and the SH here and just think about the S, Z, and X, show how we do it. And as I noticed before, this is a rule that gets applied kind of regardless of whether the S in question is a plural noun suffix or a third person verb suffix. So this rule is not kind of terribly aware of the grammar of what's going on. It's more a kind of just at the level of spelling. So let's see how we would cook up a second transducer that would correspond to a rule like this. How am I getting on? Okay. Now this is a bit of a scary picture. It's taken from the Jurafsky and Martin book. But basically, you stare at it for long enough, you realise this does what you want. So it takes an input, which can be a sequence of characters, and can also be this morpheme boundary symbol and the word boundary symbol. So you'll see a few of those things there. And we're particularly interested in what happens when we see Zs and Ss and Xs. So they appear quite a lot. These are the input symbols, so where we have a colon, these appear on the left-hand side of colon. And I've written question mark as something that can stand for any other letter in the alphabet, any other letter that's not one of these. So A, B, C, D, E, all. You just do, question mark tells you what to do in any other case. Okay. And as before, where the input's the same as the output, I've not written colon, so this means this transition here would be input Z, output Z, or input S, output S, or input X, output X. We've also got this end of word marker. Okay. So you should also think that when we read in an end of word marker, there's a convention that we should probably output not a hash symbol, but a space character or something. That would be nice for the reader. So let's see roughly how this works. So state 0 is the state we're in most of the time. So most things take us from state 0 to itself, okay? And we don't care about anything else until we see a Z or an S or an X, okay? And if we see, because the thing we're trying to detect is a Z or an S or an X occurring at just before a morpheme boundary. So we're trying to detect a Z or an S or an X followed by this morpheme boundary, because then we want to be on the alert, because then we want to know that if we've got this S morpheme after that, then we need to insert the E. Okay, so this state one records that we've just seen a Z or an S or an X. Okay, and if we see another one, then we stay in that state. If we see anything else, then we go back to the beginning. Then, if we see a morpheme boundary marker, we go into state two. Okay. And now suppose we do indeed get this sequence of the S morpheme occurring at the end of the word, okay? We can silently jump to state 3, outputting an E, so with reading no input, and then read in the S and output the S, and then read in the end of the word marker, so we can do that. If we see anything other than an S, we basically go, or a Z or an X, we go back to the beginning. There's another thing which can happen, which we can see an S which doesn't occur at the end of a word, okay? So if we see an S that doesn't occur at the end of a word, we can jump here, and then, depending on what we get after that, we can jump somewhere else. But notice that from this state 5, There's no transition to jump to on this end of the word marker. So if we see S followed by end of the word, we could non-deterministically either jump there or there. But if we jump there, then there's nowhere to go after that. Whereas if we go here, then we reach the end of the word, then we can go back there. But this state 5, it is important because if we've got an X at the end of a morpheme followed by an S that's not at the end of the word, for instance, in something like X servicemen, we need to know we don't want to insert an E there. Okay, it's only this morpheme S by itself at the end of the word that wants to trigger that. So you may need to stare at this a while, but it works. Okay, I've got time for a clicker question. Okay. Yeah. Don't spend too long on it. How many possible sequences of transitions can be triggered by the word? Yeah, by the input asses. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, or more than 4. Don't worry too much about getting it wrong. Just have a stab. We've not got much time. Okay, so most of you thought there were 3. Some of you thought there were 4. Some of you thought there were 5. Okay, that's not bad for the time you had. But basically, the more you thought there were, the more right you were, because this surprised me. So I kind of thought there were about 3 or 4 to begin with. Actually, I think there are 10. And you can say more than 4 is the right answer. So you can enjoy at your leisure reading this on the web and working that out. So these correspond, these are the sequences of transitions, and these are the ways it would try to insert morpheme breaks into this. Yeah. Okay. There is one slide I haven't talked about, which is this slide. So I've nearly caught up. So I'll talk about this slide last time, and then we'll go on to the last topic in the regular language part of the course, which is only sort of about regular languages, because it's how to tell when a language isn't a regular language. It's about a thing called the pumping lemma.
Question. And Pierceberg. Languages that have feminine and masculine.
Yes.
When there are like differences between like
yep.
different
so like French, no, for example.
Like in Spanish, like from Spain, you know.
Yeah.
Some words are masculine. Mm-hmm. When in Spanish from Latin America, they are feminine.
The same words are feminine, right?
So for new words that they can have either feminine or masculine because they come from English, like BlackBerry or
right,
iPhone.
Yeah. Like, sorry, I just need to log. Yeah.
One of them.
I can log you.
Okay. Thanks. I'll just need to. I'll need to do something anyway. Okay. Yeah. I'll talk to you in just a sec.
Yeah. No problem.
Right. Probably safe to do that. Right, sorry, it's just slightly overrun. Can I, is that okay if I
leave? Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to go to the next one.
So on the accelerated Java program for grad students, so you sign up to take control. I'm working as hard as I can, like 3-4 hours
sure.
a day. And the question is, well, Dr. Paul Jackson talked to me about taking the exam, right? So I'm wanting to know how it's going to happen. Am I going to take the assignments? Am I going to take the project?
Yeah, so what will happen is that next semester you'll basically do this course, but there won't be, you know, you'll have to self-study for the lecture.